members of the church, education is not merely a good idea, it's a commandment. We are to learn of things both in heaven and in the earth and under the earth, things which have been, things which are, things which must shortly come to pass, things which are at home, things which are abroad.
Welcome to Insights. I'm Marilee Stallings. Photography appears so easy today in our digital world. Take a picture, attach the camera to a computer, and print it out. No waiting. It wasn't always so easy. We have with us today John Telford, Professor of Visual Arts at Brigham Young University. He's not just a professor. He is also a professional photographer. His photos are featured in books, magazine articles, and online exhibits as well. John, thank you for being with us today on Insights.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Marilee.
Well, apparently you got interested in photography while serving a mission. Is that right?
That's correct. Before I went on my mission, my interest was baseball. I was on my way to a professional baseball career and actually turned down an offer from the New York Mets to go on my mission, which was in the South Pacific and the Samoan Islands. Once I arrived there, I realized this is a pretty nice place. I probably ought to have a photographic record of this place, and so started taking pictures initially with an old Instamatic camera. Realized quite soon that was not going to give me the quality that I wanted to have. So I invested in a little bit better camera at that particular point, and by the end of my mission, I had been kind of designated as the mission photographer by the mission president. And anytime something photographic needed to be done, I was called on to do that. So consequently, we had a visit from the then junior member of the Quorum of the Twelve, who came to the islands. As part of his visit, he went to one of the outer islands that had not had a visit from an apostle for about 20 years. And as part of that visit, he was given a very high respect ceremony. As he entered the grounds for that ceremony, he handed me his Argus C3 camera and asked if I'd take some pictures for him. I didn't know how his camera worked. I took a couple of pictures. I don't know if they turned out at all, but I decided I would take some pictures with my own camera and make copies and provide them for him in a little booklet, a little brochure, a little something of remembrance, along with a complete description of the ceremony, this respect ceremony that was given to him, as best as I could, interpreting the speeches that were given. Which are very high speech, high language Samoan speakers that are giving these talks.
Very formal, for some.
Very, very formal, and sent those to him. So I always look back on that and say that was the actual first assignment that I was given to make photographs for someone else. Well, that then junior member of the Quorum of the Twelve is currently the president of the church, Thomas S. Monson.
Oh, my.
So my mission provided me an opportunity to begin what has become a lifelong pursuit for me, making photographs of the landscape and making photographs about the church and the history of the church.
Well, looking a little bit about the history of photography, what was the first kind of photograph?
Well, the very first photographs were daguerreotypes. They were an elusive process made on a polished copper metal plate in which silver nitrate was coated onto that plate. It was exposed in a camera and, in essence, developed in fumes of mercury.
Ooh.
As you look back, it would be considered a very dangerous process because of the use of the mercury. But it continues to be one of the most beautiful photographic processes that has ever existed. The process that we have followed for 150-plus years has been a process of making negatives and subsequently prints in the camera. That was invented by William Henry Fox Talbot in the the dates are a little bit elusive also because these are experiments that go on over a decade or more. But typically the date given for the invention of photography is 1839, and William Henry Fox Talbot making what he referred to as the pencil of nature in the early 1840s, mid-1840s, and photography has progressed from there, a very rudimentary, ill-defined new medium to become what today is the ubiquitous medium of the 20th and now the 21st century.
Oh, yeah. Photography is now everywhere. A couple of years ago, the Church History Library conducted a series of lectures on preserving our personal histories. And the lecture on photographic conservation talked about all the different kinds of substances used to capture an image, even the whites of eggs. I think he called it albumen print. What other processes were used to create photographs?
Albumen was used for a long period of time during the last half of the 19th century. It was replaced with gelatin. It's still the light-sensitive material that is used as silver. The egg white in that form, or the albumen, was simply a vehicle to hold that paper or hold that silver onto the photographic paper. By the late 19th century and through most of the 20th century, gelatin was used as the binder to hold that silver as an emulsion onto the photographic paper. Today, we've almost, but not totally, gone away from those silver processes as we've moved into the digital era and using what is the correct term, I guess, would be the digital inks. But as a traditional old photographer, I refer to it as we're making photographs with food coloring today, where in the previous century we were doing precious metals, silver.
So tintype. Mm-hmm. I know tintype became a very popular, inexpensive type of photography. What was used for tintype?
Well, tintype is another one that it is an albumen type process. The silver is still coated on the material, but in that particular instance, it is tin that is the substrate that holds the emulsion. There was also at the same time a very similar process that is known as an ambrotype. Mm-hmm. That was a similar to the daguerreotype, was a one-of-a-kind process done on glass in this particular instance, and then backed with a black material that made the image appear to be a positive image, where in actuality it really was a negative image, but because of the black background it appeared to be positive. The tintype is basically that same thing that uses what they called a japanned metal, which is a blackening process that blackens the tin, first of all, and then the emulsion is put on top of that and subsequently appears to be a positive image. Tintypes were extremely popular during the Civil War. In fact, right up to probably the 1880s, 1890s, the tintypes were still being used a great deal. Inexpensive, albeit one-of-a-kind, a process that was used by itinerant photographers across the whole country.
How big were the cameras?
The cameras used through most of the 19th century had to be big enough for the subsequent picture, the subsequent image that was made from that camera. There was no enlarging done until late in the 19th century and then on into the 20th century. So if you had an 8x10 print from the 19th century, it would be made from an 8x10 negative or an 8x10 camera. The 8x10 camera utilized by many, many photographers was relatively small, you might say, compared to those photographers who were making large imagery. Carlton Watkins, for example, making monumental photographs in the Yosemite and other areas in California, was using what he referred to as his mammoth plate camera, making photographs that were 18 by 24 inches, 20 by 24 inches, all from glass plate negatives, wet collodion negatives, meaning that he was out there with a camera that would facilitate 20 by 24 inch glass plates.
Oh, my.
That were then coated with wet collodion, which in its own right is a very interesting process, dipped into silver nitrate to make it light sensitive, placed in the camera before that wet collodion dried, then developed before the wet collodion totally dried, before he could make a print from it, an albumen print, by the way, with those beautiful tones. But if you can imagine, you know, the likes of Carlton Watkins or William Henry Jackson or Timothy O'Sullivan, these monumental Western landscape photographers, Timothy O'Sullivan also a Civil War photographer, but using these large, cumbersome cameras, carrying a supply of glass plates that would be coated on site, then processed on site before they could proceed to the printmaking process. So the if you can just imagine carrying enough glass, and of course the weight of that glass, to be able to make photographs on the expeditions that they went on. I mentioned Carlton Watkins in the Yosemite in California. William Henry Jackson was doing those kind of photographs in Yellowstone in the early 1870s, which were subsequently used to promote to Congress the establishment of Yellowstone National Park as not only the country's first national park, but the world's first national park. And as a photographer, I credit William Henry Jackson with establishing the Yellowstone as a national park, because it was his photographs that really convinced Congress that that country was real, that those legends, those rumors that had been told by the mountain men of glass mountains and burning mountains and fissures of steam and being able to catch a fish, as Jim Bridger, I believe it was, told his tale of being able to catch a fish and reeling it in and cooking it before you actually got it to shore.
Oh, my.
Congress didn't believe those stories. But when Jackson's photographs appeared with the hot springs and the geysers and the obsidian mountains and the those, then they realized it was real and subsequently established Yellowstone as the world's first national park.
I'm just stunned by the magnitude of what those gentlemen did and the work that they went through to bring us these images. They weren't just, they weren't romantic paintings. They were the real thing. They were showing the real thing.
Well, and when Ferdinand V. Hayden invited Jackson to go with him on the first official expedition of the Yellowstone conducted by the U.S. Geological Survey, he invited Jackson to go with him. He also invited Thomas Moran to go with him to make paintings of the area. But he realized that the Moran's paintings would be looked at as somewhat fictitious because of, you know, the imaginary, the artistic license that might be taken. But the photograph does not lie. At least that's what it was believed in the 19th century. The photograph was truth and represented reality. And so as rudimentary as they may have been, those photographs represented reality. And as you can well imagine, it was a tremendous amount of work for Jackson to make those several hundred photographs that he did that first year. There's an interesting story told of his photograph of Tower Falls. which today is a lovely little visitor center and snack bar on a nice trail that takes you down to Tower Falls. In 1870, when he made the photograph of Tower Falls, none of that existed.
That's right.
He made the determination that he wanted to get a lower view than the typical trail view that was available for Tower Falls. So if you can follow this, he first of all scurried down about 180 feet of scree slope to determine where he wanted to make the photograph. He then had to climb back up that 180 feet to get his camera and take it down to that spot.
And this was not a small camera. This is
an 8x10 camera that he was using to do this with. He then had to climb back up that scree slope to coat his glass in wet collodion and then get it down to the camera before it dried, make an exposure, take it back up, and process it in his portable tent. The first exposure was a failure, so he had to do it all over again. The second exposure was also a failure, and so he had to do it all over again. It took three tries before he actually got a glass plate that was properly exposed and would render a decent print. He was then successful, other than his camera was still down at the bottom of the scree slope, so he had to go back down, gather all of that equipment up, and bring it back up. That was the life of a 19th century photographer, making photographs that today we look at as monumental historic documents of significant importance. But that process, you know, I've tried to think, how long would it have taken him to make that one photograph? You know, the better part of a day.
Yeah.
To do that one photograph.
Oh, my. Thank you for joining us on the Mormon Channel. You're listening to Insights, where we are discussing the science and art of photography. John, we've talked about some real innovators and some movers in early photography, especially in the American West. Who are some innovators and photographers that have inspired you?
Early on in my photographic education, was introduced to the work of Ansel Adams and his monumental work of the landscape. Being a Utahn by birth and raised in Utah and visiting many national parks as a youngster, when I took up the camera, I naturally started to gravitate toward landscape photography. And so when I saw the work of Ansel Adams as a young student, it was inspiring to me. It was mind-boggling to see the quality, the beauty of the photographs that he had made. A few years later, I had the opportunity of actually studying with Ansel Adams and getting to know him on a little bit more of a personal basis. Seeing him not only as a incredible photographer, but also seeing him as a human being and some of the things that he had done. So he was, and probably still is, the first and foremost influence on my personal photography.
And what impact did his work have overall? I mean, was it just a local impact, or did he have more of a...
Well, as we throw that name out, Ansel Adams, he's one of the few photographers that I think is somewhat of a household name. There's not a lot of people who are totally oblivious to the legacy of Ansel Adams and what he did. He certainly has had influence in photography, both as a photographer, but also as a teacher, as a practitioner, teaching the processes that he was so accomplished at to many, many other young photographers who have emulated and followed in his particular style of photography. But there are certainly others that possibly are not so well known but have had significant and similar influence in the history of photography. West Coast style photographers, as we refer to them, Edward Weston, Wynn Bullock, Imogene Cunningham, Dorothea Lange, who was a more of a documentary photojournalist type photographer, whose work, by the way, is currently on exhibit at the Museum of Art at Brigham Young University, having photographed, as it's referred to, as Three Mormon Towns. in the 1950s and looking at the lifestyle of people there that is significant through the eyes of a gifted photographer. Most people probably know the very important photograph that Dorothea Lange did during the Depression era called Migrant Mother. That is a iconic photograph in the history of photography. She lamented that she was a one-photograph photographer, having been known only for that photograph of Migrant Mother. But history and her archive points out that she did some incredible work through her entire life as a photographer. So these are other early photographers and all of those 20th century photographers that have had a significant influence on the history of photography. And then, of course, there are others that are more contemporary who have also made significant contributions as photography has evolved into a full-fledged member of the art community.
Going back to Ansel Adams, what kind of a camera did he use?
Ansel used a variety of cameras, but the camera, again, that is most commonly used in those photographs that are traditionally the photographs that we know of Ansel Adams were almost all made with an 8x10 camera, 8x10 negative that he early on in his career made what we refer to as a contact print, meaning a print that is the same size of the negative, made in contact with the negative. But as he advanced in his own ability and his own career, he made enlargements from those negatives. Traditionally, about 16 by 20 inches, and then frequently much larger mural size images from those negatives. He did what is referred to as the mural project, largely during the war, the Second World War years, working in the national parks, but making mural size prints, 40 by 60 inches or even larger than that from those large negatives. But again, he used many of his very important photographs were made with a medium format Hasselblad camera, particularly toward the end of his photographic life. Others were made with other large format cameras, but 4x5 inches, 5x7 inches. So there's a whole variety of cameras that he used. But again, the photographs I think that we look at as his most famous photographs were typically done with the 8x10 camera.
What was the first camera that normal people could start to purchase and work with?
George Eastman introduced the camera that is commonly referred to as the Brownie or the roll film cameras as early as the 1890s. 1898, I believe, is the date that George Eastman introduced the Kodak, as my grandparents used to refer to it as. Roll film was introduced very shortly thereafter. So the combination of roll film and a handheld camera that was put into the hands of any person who purchased that camera was made available about that particular time. And with the advent of that handheld camera with roll film, by the way, early on, that camera was loaded at Eastman Kodak Company in Rochester, New York, with a roll that was capable of 100 exposures.
Oh, my.
Sent to the individual who owned the camera. The film would be exposed, and then the entire camera sent back to Kodak in Rochester, New York. The film was processed. Prints were made, and then it was reloaded with a new roll of film and sent back to the individual with their 100 prints of, beautifully printed, by the way, silver chloride prints. and they'd start all over again. Well, that put the camera into the hands of literally everyone. At that particular time, photography is taken from the few magicians that used it as their selective art form.
And who could pack all that material with them?
Yeah, and who could pack that? But then it was turned over to the to everyone. It's interesting that early historians, Allison and Helmut Gersheim, made a statement at one point that George Eastman was solely responsible for the death of serious photography.
And yet, and the birth of the snapshot.
And the birth of the snapshot and all the things that go along with that. But, of course, as we look at the evolution of the hand camera and that camera being put into the hands of gifted visual artists, photographers, we see the spontaneity and the quality of photography as it is seen in today's world that really is very either elusive or impossible to the photographer who uses the large, cumbersome camera that makes wonderful photographs of things that hold still. But when it comes to things that are moving and spontaneity and human beings and other things that require that spontaneous response, that's the camera that photographers use today, is that very fast, very quick, very spontaneous camera that is the ultimate evolution of what George Eastman introduced in the 1890s.
Well, and I think most people... I think it became so popular because people could take photographs of people and places that they wanted to remember. And now, lo, these generations later, we treasure the ones that we can find.
Well, it's an interesting look. You know, as you look in the history of photography, I credit William Henry Jackson with making photographs of the Yellowstone that established it as a national park. Mm-hmm. I credit Ansel Adams with making photographs of the landscape and the earth gestures, as he referred to it, that are monumental and inspiring. But in none of those photographs are the individual family record found. So that as we evolve with the camera to put it into the hands of literally everyone, every individual, those individuals then become the record keepers of the individual family. And the family photographs, which record our activities on Christmas morning or on birthdays or on other occasions or on vacations.
The wedding photographs.
The wedding photographs. These are about the individuals that make up our lives. They are personal. They are... Well, it's interesting to look at those photographs and see that as a member of the family has a camera, we present a different human, we present a different personality to the family photographer than we do to the professional photographer in whose studio we go or may come to our events to photograph important things like weddings. But that photographer is an outsider. We present a different person to that photographer than we do to the family photographer. We're much more casual. We're much more honest, if you will, of who we actually are to the family photographer than we are to the outsider professional photographer. So Yeah. That's we see that evolution in photography, that where those early photographers are making monumental records of important places throughout the world. When the camera is finally put into the hands of literally everyone, we suddenly see the folksy, humanistic side of photography that
and
is
maybe
made
not
of,
your best side.
Well, maybe not your best side, but it's maybe it's your authentic side.
Yes. You're listening to Insights on the Mormon Channel. We're discussing photography with John Telford, professor of visual arts at Brigham Young University. Well, we've talked about history and science and the popularity of photography, but What makes a photo a piece of art as opposed to just a piece of paper with a chemical image captured on it?
Well, we go back to this conversation we're having about putting the camera into literally everybody's hands. The advertisers today would have us believe that if your pictures aren't good enough, your camera's not good enough. And what you need to do is go out and buy a better camera. If you buy a better camera, as the advertisers will tell us, you'll make better pictures. I don't subscribe to that theory. In fact, the theory that I subscribe to is cameras don't take pictures. People do. People take pictures with cameras. Camera is just simply the instrument that we use. There's a fallacy also in the thinking today that because I own a good camera, therefore I are a photographer. That holds as much validity to say that because I went to the piano store and bought a Steinway, therefore I am a better piano player. And I think we all realize that is not true. Owning a Steinway means you own a Steinway.
You spend a lot of money.
And you spend a lot of money. Owning a good camera also frequently means you spend a lot of money. But the ability to make a photograph is in the mind and the eyes of the holder of that camera. So I emphasize, people take pictures, not cameras. And what we do with that camera makes it the snapshot or makes it the work of art, depending on our sensitivity, our understanding of very elusive elements, you might say, that come together in a spontaneous form that create a found composition or things similar to that. So I emphasize, as I teach photography, that a photographer has to make two decisions every time the camera is used. Every time a picture is made, the photographer has to make two decisions. Now, most of the time, they're done subconsciously. Most of the time, we never think about it. And, of course, that's why the photographs look like they look. But the decisions that you have to make are, where do I point the camera? And when do I click the shutter? Now, it sounds very simplistic, but if you think about it, where I point the camera determines what's going to be included in that picture. But possibly even more important is what is not going to be included in that picture. What is superficial or superfluous to the photograph that I'm trying to make? Other photographers that I've respect have said that the best zoom lens you can buy is your own 2 feet. Just simply get closer. If it's not good enough, you're not close enough. So this idea of where do I point the camera becomes very important to what is going to be in the picture.
You know, you say that, and I think about a lot of the pictures that I've taken, and I was simply too far away. The subject or the person is small in the picture, and it's like, get closer.
So that's what they say. Buy a better zoom lens. I guess we'd have to say, no, don't buy a better zoom lens. Buy better running shoes so you can get closer to what you need to photograph. The second thing that I point out is, when do you click the shutter? There's so many funny stories about cameras going off at the wrong moment, capturing the wrong expression, capturing the wrong situation. But this, when do I click the shutter, the significance of the decisive moment when all the things come together. When you click the shutter may mean I'm taking the picture at the wrong time of day. The light's not right. The light doesn't reveal my subject the way it should be. It may mean that I'm taking the picture at the wrong time of year. You know, there's simplistic things. Autumn trees, for a matter of fact, look best in the autumn.
Yes.
Not in the winter.
Yes.
There are other things that you could say look best at a particular season of the year. So clicking the shutter at a particular time may mean the instant of a second that it's clicked. It may mean the time of day or even the time of year when that picture is taken. These are things that sensitive photographers are aware of. The quality of light, the compositional elements, where things are placed within the frame. the spontaneous moment, when the expression is at its best. All of these things contribute to the photograph that stands out as significant and memorable, as opposed to the many snapshots that we see that we just simply made a record of a moment in time, but there was nothing really significant happening possibly at that instant that the camera is utilized. So again, you know, it sounds simplistic, but cameras don't take pictures. People do. I facetiously tell my class that I put my camera out in the yard one time and left it there for a week or so to seeing how many good pictures it would take. It didn't do a single one. It takes me as a photographer to operate that camera to make it do what it's capable of doing.
Now, you are most well known for your landscape photography, and I've seen some articles online, and it is absolutely exquisite. You do have a beautiful eye. You do know when to take that picture and where to point the camera. Where do you like to go to get those images? Where's your favorite location?
Well, there's been a number of places that I've been that I'd say, you know, these are wonderful places to go. You know, it's hard to just say this is where I go to make photographs. When I have a little bit of time, I'll go someplace that's fairly close and make photographs of places that are close by. When I have time, I'll maybe go someplace that is a little bit farther away and make photographs of other places. It's probably another trap in photography to think that good photographs are not available in my backyard. They're only available in some other country or some other state or someplace far away.
Someplace exotic.
Someplace exotic. We have to realize, you know, we're doing this this interview in Provo, Utah. And as we look around us, there are some rather spectacular mountains that are within eyeshot. There are some rather spectacular national parks that were within a few hours' drive that people from all over the world come to take pictures of and visit. We have to realize that we have some monumental things that are very, very close by. We don't need to go far away to do these, to make photographs. But yet there is a mentality amongst a lot of people, this what I refer to as the greener grass mentality, that says the grass is greener somewhere else than it is close to where I'm located. So you say, where do I like to photograph? I like to photograph where my camera is.
as long as you're with the camera, it's okay.
I go places to photograph rather than photographing the places where I go. That's a little bit different in a way of saying that my reason for going to places frequently is to make the photographs. And so when I am there, I am conscious of the light, I'm conscious of the landforms, I'm conscious of whatever is around me. But it doesn't necessarily mean I have to go to South America or to the Pacific or someplace. That's where photographs are made. Yes, I like those places, and I photographed in those places. But I also thoroughly enjoy going up over the mountain that's right close nearby, and I can take an hour or 2 hours when I have a moment and slip off into these mountains and make photographs without having to get on an airplane or make a long voyage somewhere. So the places where I like to photograph are the places where I happen to be at the moment.
Well, then maybe the better question would be is, where have you had the most fun with your camera?
I enjoy the national parks. I've enjoyed and consider it a privilege to have been able to go to the Holy Lands and make photographs. I've considered a privilege to go to the places where Joseph Smith or other early members of the church spent time in organizing the church and these important church history sites. I've had the privilege of photographing in Cuba. I've had the privilege of photographing in the Patagonia country in South America. I've had the privilege of photographing in China and other places that are wonderful places to visit and make photographs. But I also have to say I don't know that I make better photographs when I travel long distances than I do when I'm right close. It's great to be able to photograph in Zion National Park or Capitol Reef National Park or Bryce Canyon National Park. These are monumental places where people from all over the world come. It's interesting to stand on the rim at one of the popular viewpoints in Bryce Canyon and realize that English is not the most common language that's being spoken. There are people from all over the world that come to our backyard to photograph places that are within a matter of a few hours from us. So I enjoy all of these places, and I've had the privilege of going to many places that have afforded me opportunities to make photographs.
What do you look for when you set up your camera? As you're in a place and you're looking around, what is it that draws your eye?
Well, but before I answer that, I can also quote another photographer friend of mine, Al Weber, who's a photographer in Carmel, California, who one time made the statement, "I would rather see what a good photographer would do with a mediocre landscape than what a mediocre photographer would do with a good or spectacular landscape." So as I go to places, I'm not necessarily looking for the monumental, iconic viewpoints or the things that we have all seen. I look for light. The first thing I look for typically when I'm out is the quality of light. When I see a quality of light that I recognize is conducive to make photographs, I then look for things within that light that would make an interesting composition. I, again, facetiously refer to myself as a hunter-gatherer as a photographer, quoting another photographer who said, "Photographers don't compose anything. The compositions are already in existence. The problem for the photographer is to find them and steal them," as he said. So this is what I look for. Number one, I look for the quality of light, and then within that light, I look for interesting compositional elements, juxtapositions of elements. That may mean the big landscape. It may mean the very intimate landscape.
I know there was one picture that caught my eye, and I'm trying to remember. I think they were just – they looked like it was a forest scene, and they looked like lily blades or, those big, wide, broad, like Lily of the Valley. Anyway, I don't know exactly what it was, mm-hmm. but it was up close. And it was just this beautiful, beautiful golden green. And I remember looking at that going, oh, can I just pull up a hammock mm-hmm. and a book and, mm-hmm. and enter that little spot?
Well, and that's, those intimate little things that we see can be as profound and as powerful as seeing the big mountain in Alpenglow or another unbelievable quality of light or things like that. So, yes, there's a lot of what we refer to as the intimate landscape that provides a significant opportunity to make meaningful photographs. And you respond in a way that, as I've stated, is kind of my artist statement or my mission goal in photography. My approach to photography is to allow individuals to see those photographs that will nurture their souls, as opposed to being photographs that simply stimulate their thought processes. I want to engage a viewer on a affective level of emotion that nurtures them spiritually, as opposed to just cognitively or academically.
Now, a few years ago, you kind of broke from your colored landscape tradition, and you took a little tour along U.S. Highway 89 in Utah, and you photographed people in black and white. What was that like for you? What was that trip all about?
Well, this was a different thing, as you accurately point out. It was turning from something that's very, very comfortable to me and turning to a subject matter that is not quite so comfortable, photographing people in their specific environment. But it is a project that has been in the back of my mind for actually a long time, that I've thought about photographing people in their environment and making nice portraits of them. Earlier in our conversation, I made reference to Dorothea Lange's photographs of three Mormon towns. Those photographs have influenced me in a way that I've looked back at them and realized that she came from her comfort zone, from her home in California or someplace like that, to Utah to make photographs of Mormons in rural towns in southern Utah. And she made beautiful photographs of these people and explored their lifestyle and what they were about. All those photographs have sat in the back of my mind for a lot of years. So I travel up and down this circuitous highway through Utah, U.S. 89, and came to the conclusion at one point that I needed to really spend some time looking, meeting the people who live close to this, as I refer to it, this bucolic highway that's in usually more rural areas of the state, as opposed to the speed-by mentality of the interstate system, which in many cases is either about 30 miles away from U.S. 89, or in some instances they run on the same path through the state. Well, as I began photographing individuals, I initially thought, I'll find an individual and spend 10 or 15 minutes with them, make a photograph, learn a little bit about them, maybe a half hour. But as I started photographing these people and started to talk to them, each of those photographic sessions, those interviews, if you will, lasted 2 hours, maybe 3 hours, as I learned more and more about these people and their stories and the significant things that they have accomplished in their life and the contributions that they make, not only in their communities but to society as a whole. I did it in black and white because it was a little bit more of a documentary medium. The color in that particular instance would just get in the way of the personality of the individuals. I also did it with an unusual format camera, a panorama type camera. Most people, in fact, in today's digital world, we refer to vertical photographs as portrait mode, and we refer to horizontal photographs as landscape mode. So when we think portrait, we think vertical. Well, these portraits are all done in extended horizontal format, exploring not only the individual but also their environment and the things that they do. But the real fun of this whole story was to get to know these people for a short period of time, but to learn their stories, to hear them talk about what they do in their lives, and realize that these people are making significant contributions to their community, to their region, but in many instances, their products and art forms and things that they produce are transported all around the world. And so it was a really fun project, and I continue to think that it's not over, that I will add to it as time goes on.
Now, you said that you're working on a new book. It's a new project. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, it's not so much a new project as it is a project that is timely right now, as we're in our Sunday school and gospel doctrine classes particularly. We're into talking about the Savior. in the New Testament. Susan Easton Black and I had an opportunity, it's actually been about 10 years ago, to go to the Holy Lands, and I made photographs of the Holy Lands, and together we produced a book called In the Footsteps of Jesus, Personal Pilgrimage to the Holy Lands. It includes my photographs, Susan's text is doctrinal about the life of the Savior and some of the things that happened there. But I also am grateful that the publishers included many excerpts from my own journal, which makes it a little bit of a personal story as well, as our and I refer to it as a personal pilgrimage to the Holy Lands, where I had the opportunity to visit with my wife and two of my daughters. To visit those very significant places. So that book has been republished, as it were. It's currently available as a document, as a book about the life of the Savior and the Holy Lands as they appear today.
And you have several other books that deal with Utah landscape, and as well as church history sites.
Of the 17 books that I've been part of published, about half of those have to do with church-related topics, church history kind of topics that are significant to me. It gives me an opportunity to contribute to the fabric of the church in my own small way, also. My love of making photographs of the landscape, but in this particular case, landscape that is significant to not only church history, but religious history as well.
In 2007, you gave a devotional address at BYU. You made an interesting observation on how photography was being invented at the same time that the church was being restored. I'd like to know more of your thoughts on that.
Well, the church is organized in 1830. In 1839, the first published record of photography is given to the world by the French government. These are the photographs of Daguerre, and he turned his findings over to the French, who then published it to the world. The correlation that I make is that photography is a medium of light. The word literally means painting or drawing with light. Photography as I have practiced this medium, I've come to realize more and more that it is a medium that gathers light and records light. It doesn't record dark. It doesn't record dark things. It records the light. When we see dark things in a photograph, it simply represents the absence of light. But the medium that we're using is responsive to light, not necessarily to dark. So I looked at this as the church is unfolding, as the evolution of the organization of the church comes about. It is frequently referred to as a period of light, that light that not only illuminates but enlightens us and gives us spiritual understanding of significant things. Photography being a medium that paints with light, also coming about at that same period of time, has the potential to bring a light into the world and to make record or make images that are about positive things and about things that both enlighten us, but also things that are illuminate us. So those are the parallels that I tried to make in that devotional address that I gave here at BYU.
John, thank you so much for being with us here on Insights. And if you'd like to see John Telford's photography, use any internet search engine and type in John Telford Photographer. You will find amazingly beautiful images. We also invite you to visit our website, radio.lds.org, and let us know if there are topics you would like us to investigate and discuss, things you would like to learn. You've been listening to Insights on the Mormon Channel. I'm Marilee Stallings.